I think, you know, there's a lot of attitudes that have been passed down in particular areas through particular viewpoints and families through the generations that are still very much rooted in the days of, as you say, somebody being LGBT plus being a figure of fun or dangerous or wrong in some way. And that's the real difficulty, isn't it? Trying to, you know, change those mindsets so that the daily experience is actually a much better one. And that is, I think, what's vital in the work that, you know, you do, especially. Hello, friends, and thank you for joining me for the Way Forward podcast brought to you by me, Fliss Goldsmith, and Co-Design Coaching, where we create your optimal life together. Today, I am joyful to have John Yates Harold in the studio with me. John, welcome to the Way Forward, and thank you for agreeing to be in the studio with us today.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're so, so welcome. So let me tell you a little bit about John before we dive into today's fascinating topic. John identifies as gay and non-binary, and their lived experiences as well as professional work are what we're blessed to be discussing today. John is a project officer at Derbyshire LGBT+. And before moving up to Derbyshire in 2016, John was a primary school teacher and deputy head in London for 28 years. They're also a composer and performer. They co-founded the London Gay Men's Choir in 1990, and John has written a Requiem Mass, three operas for children, a Spanish song cycle, and countless other pieces of music and songs. And I should add some absolutely fab educational resources for books that are out there as well. So with that said, John, do you ever sleep?
No, I mean, music has been a massive part of my life from day one. And to have that outlet to, you know, through the writing and the performing, it is such a massive part of my life. It gives me so much satisfaction.
Do you think it's something that's helped you cope with a lot of things in life as well?
I do, yeah. I mean, I find, because I have levels of anxiety and depression, to be able to explore that through music and to be able to sit at the piano and sing lifts my mood no end and gives me so much joy.
There is a real power in music, actually. I introduced my mum yesterday. She's 72, if she's listening to this. Yes, I did just say your age on air, mother, to Spotify. And honestly, it's like the world opened up to her because she loves music. And now she's like, I can take this wherever I go. I can listen to it wherever I am. And just that joy of having music in your life is a huge, huge thing.
My life has been immeasurably improved by Spotify.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I mean, I wake up with music in my head and I think, oh, I'll listen to that on my way to work, or I'll listen to that while I'm cooking. And just to have that facility, just to be able to say, I want to listen to Stravinsky today, or I want to listen to Tori Amos, or I want Kate Bush or Mark Almond, or, you know, some really obscure industrial metal stuff. And just to be able to say, yeah, it's there and at my fingertips. And my Spanish song cycle is on Spotify.
Okay, so, I need to go. Yes, I'm gonna find that, and we could put it in the show notes, actually, because fabulous. I think everyone should have a listen. So, John, I'd like to go back a little, if we may, to when you were growing up through the 70s, at the 80s and into the 90s. I want to ask you how you felt amongst your peers, specifically considering what the landscape was around being openly LGBT plus back then?
I mean, I knew from a very early age, literally as soon as I walked out of the door and started mixing with anybody outside the house, that I was different. I didn't know how different or what that was, or didn't have the language for it. But I didn't like doing the stuff all the other boys liked to do. I wasn't into football. I wasn't into all the rough and tumble. I didn't want to get dirty and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I knew I just didn't fit in. And, you know, I was at nursery and then primary. I literally thought, you only attended primary school for one day.
Oh.
So I know. So when my mother dragged me, literally, I've got a very vivid memory of being dragged down these corridors, kicking and screaming and crying when on the second day when my mother had to take me in. You know, I was very academic, threw myself into schoolwork as a way of trying to be better than everybody else. And I think as LGBT plus people, we do that, which is why you get so many incredible LGBT sports people and musicians who are really successful. We have to prove that we're better than everybody else.
Right.
And we find our niche where we kind of can feel we belong. Not that we fit in necessarily, but where we belong. Mm. And we do everything we can to be the very, very best we can. And I think that's what kind of was a driver to becoming a teacher and to being successful with that. That, you know, it's just that innate feeling of having to create our own world,
yeah,
where we can succeed and achieve. So, you know, that was how I navigated the early part of my life through academia.
Yeah, finding that point at which you feel you excel and really honing in on that in order to, like you say, belong, to find that sense of belonging. So as you were going through primary school, which did last for more than one day, unfortunately, so it got my heart when you said that, because I can just think back to, you know, taking my own children to primary school, and it must be a strange thing to suddenly think, oh, what, this is a constant thing now, is it? I have to do this like all the time. Going into secondary education, did that make you more aware or more understanding of what was different about you? How did that play out?
Well, I'd gone through 7 years of hell at primary, being bullied verbally. And then I started secondary and the bullying became physical. So virtually on a daily basis, being beaten up by older kids. They taught me the language about me. So I knew, I was different, didn't fit in. And I vividly remember being sort of 12 and hearing the word gay for the first time. And suddenly that's me, that's who I am. They've recognised that in me. They've got through the mask and the armour that I'd put on to kind of hide myself and shield myself from the world. And they had seen me. And I thought I was hiding it. And obviously I wasn't. Yeah. I remember our school was, it was horrendous. But great big fields in front of the main building. And one lad shouting from one end of the field to me, "Oi, Yates, you homo."
Right.
And I'm there thinking, why are they calling me a washing powder?
Sorry. It's an inappropriate laugh in the middle of a really trying circumstances.
I didn't know what an homo was. All I knew was it's something you washed your clothes in.
Yeah.
You know. Other kids, other kids taught me about me. You know, I remember having a conversation with somebody about Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
Oh, and you know why he called his band Queen? Because that's slang for a gay man. God, you go looking for all these little glimmers of people mentioning stuff. And is it positive? Mostly negative. Because we were figures of fun. We, you know, in the media and TV, it was Larry Grayson and John Inman. All those people who were hilarious and sexless and not a threat to anybody, because they were figures of fun, and it was, you know, and the newspapers and everybody kind of compounding all that.
Absolutely.
And just making me feel there was something wrong with it. So I grew up with such a sense of shame around who I was, and that I was going to grow up and I was going to be lonely and I was never going to find someone to love. And it was just that constant feeling of isolation. And it was so destroying.
Yeah.
For self-esteem and all that kind of stuff. So again, I was throwing myself deeper and deeper into studies, and I was top boy in the year and all that kind of stuff all the way through secondary. Really high achiever.
Yeah.
But didn't get head boy because I wasn't into sport.
Oh, well, of course you not. Know? Yeah, because, you know, looking back to then, and I grew up through the 80s and 90s, the word gay was used as a slur.
Yeah.
It was something you called people if you didn't like them.
Yeah.
That was the way, you know, we were, that was the language we were surrounded with. Yeah. And it's heartbreaking to hear your own experiences. And I'm so sorry that you were subjected to all of that just for being you.
Mm.
Because that constant barrage, as you said, of language that was, you know, pejorative, that was negative, that was derogatory. I can only imagine the layers, as you say, of armor and the shame that would cause. And the education, I mean, you know, it was only, was it 2003 that Section 28 was lifted?
In England and Wales, yeah.
Yeah. Would you just mind, for anyone listening who doesn't know what that was, to just give us a little
mini insight. Section 28 was Margaret Thatcher's government response to a book called Jenny Lives with Eric and Martin, which was a true story of a girl, I think in Denmark, who had two dads.
Mm.
And it was a book of photographs of what this family was doing. And I'll often bring this up in training that I deliver, because people can't believe the nasty, pernicious environment that this book the law created. Mm. Because the book was just a family going about their family life,
yeah,
playing board games and cooking and talking to the neighbours and all that kind of stuff. But oh no, this was going to destroy the family and undermine the very fabric of what the family stood for. So Margaret Thatcher's government brought out a clause in the local government bill, and it became law in 1988, which was the year that I started teaching. Mm. And it created a climate of fear amongst LGBT plus teachers. You know, could we come out? Could we support each other? Could we support our LGBT plus students? And the overwhelming feeling was, no, actually, we could lose our jobs. Mm. So we went back in the closet and hid it. And, you know, that climate of fear, which incidentally is what I'd grown up in, that is my overwhelming emotion going through school. And then here comes Section 28, law for 15 years and never any prosecutions, not one. But it stopped us supporting our students, supporting each other. Resources that were brought out, books, films and stuff, were very quickly re-edited to give a really negative view of being gay.
Yeah.
Libraries stopped stocking books and magazines and stuff. There was nowhere for our LGBT plus students to go and get support. There were support organisations out there, but we weren't allowed to communicate those to our students.
The damage that must have done.
Completely.
To so many people. I mean, I started university in 2003, and I look back now, because, I mean, that's, you know, 21 years ago, and I didn't realise that I had been schooled under this section 28. Yeah. It was just, you know, because I was a secondary school child, I didn't, you know, didn't question anything. And the horror it fills me with now is, so to be somebody who identified as LGBT plus in those times must have been absolutely destroying. So, you know, it sounds like it wasn't an easy time, to say the least, to identify as anything other than straight and cisgender, which to any of our listeners who are unsure of what that means, cisgender is identifying with the sex that you are assigned at birth. So if it's not too painful, what were your biggest challenges and how did you cope with those?
Well, I'd left home. I was born in Manchester. I left home at 18 for teacher training college in London. So it was that desperate attempt to look for my tribe, to look for somewhere where I could be my authentic self.
Yeah.
And I thought London was that place.
Yes, a bit more cosmopolitan.
Yeah, bigger LGBT plus community. Because when I left Manchester, there was only one pub, which was the Thompson's Arms,
yeah.
Which was under a multi-storey car park. You know, and yet you look at Manchester now.
Oh, wow, it's completely different.
But, you know, growing up and wanting to desperately find where there are others like me that weren't just in London or just weren't on just television, you know, but real people. And I was always warned by family, you don't go in the Thompson's Arms because you go in there, you'll never come out again. You know, this whole idea of predatory gay men as something dangerous and all, you know. And I remember finding the tiniest little advert, you know, not even an inch wide, in the back of the Manchester Evening News saying, are you gay? Come here for support. And, you know, and I remember, because I used to hate taking buses and things because I would get abuse on the buses. So I would walk as much as I possibly could, the 5 miles from home to get into Manchester. And I remember finding this place, because this was before internet and GPS and all that kind of stuff. So having to find this place and literally walking up the steps, finding the right door, reaching out, and then turning around again and walking back home again, because I couldn't, you know. And when we get at Derbyshire LGBT plus, when we get people coming to us, I know how difficult it is to even knock on the door or just find us and walk through and you know.
Yeah.
And that's one of the first things I always say to people is just well done for getting here and getting through the door, because I know how difficult that is.
Yeah, that it's a massive step.
It's huge. Because, you know, for lots of different reasons, people find it very difficult from whatever background they come to come into a building with a big rainbow flag on the front door and on the windows and everywhere. But so going back, I'd gone to London to escape everything that I'd grown up with. And London was this, as you say, cosmopolitan, accepting, wonderful place. And it wasn't. Teacher training was a similar nightmare for bullying. And it was only really in schools that I found my place. And I was kind of determined to be me, however that looked. My teaching career started in Inner London, in the Inner London Education Authority, which was this sort of little bubble, if you like. And I was at a school in Camden in central London, near King's Cross. And I really kind of felt I'd found my place. I found, you know, so it was an interesting journey to get there. And all the stuff that I'd kind of gone through made me more and more determined to be as out and proud as I possibly could within the restrictions of Section 28, trying to keep within the law. But there were two other gay men on the staff, which was great. So I came out on my second day and was completely accepted by everybody. Didn't come out to the kids. but was completely accepted by the staff. Having gone through 4 years of teacher training, being likened to a paedophile, because here I was, a gay man wanting to work with kids. So again, going back to what I was saying, I had to strive to be the best. And they tried so many times to chuck me out and any little excuse to get rid of me.
Simply because you were gay.
Simply because I was gay. And, you know, it was such, it was a battle. My final teaching practice in a church school in North London, my lecturer, who was supposed to be there supporting me, told my head teacher that I was gay without my knowledge. And it was quite funny because this was pre national curriculum, so we could actually teach the kids what they needed.
You know. Oh, wouldn't that be a nice thing?
Back to those days, how wonderful it would be. But so we were making bricks with straw and mud because we were doing a topic about Egypt. And the head teacher took me into her office at the end of the second week before we went off for the half-term break in October. And she said, oh, all that mud and straw in your classroom, it's looking a bit of a mess. Is it because you're gay? And I'm like, what? How does that...
Where's that connection? Yeah.
So after I'd sort of picked myself up, I thought, oh, no. So, something that was designed to undermine me with this tutor telling my head teacher completely backfired because she completely accepted me, and she even came round for dinner with a vicar friend of hers who was also gay. So, you know.
Excellent.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And I had a really successful teaching practice and really had a fabulous time. It was that level of really insidious, undermining behaviours from people who should have known better. But then it's my kind of naivety of thinking London was this wonderful, accepting place. I had more hate crime in London than I've had up in Derbyshire.
Yeah.
You know, and I was having it virtually on a daily basis.
I think it's that idea, isn't it, of it's somewhere different.
Yeah.
It's an escape.
Yeah,
so the
absolutely.
Grass has got to be greener somewhere else. But as you say, that's rarely the case, if ever. And I know that we mentioned a short while ago that you work now with Derbyshire LGBT+.
Yeah.
And I know this organisation. But could you tell the people listening about the incredible work that they do and why, most importantly, it is vital to supporting the LGBT+ community and any allies out there?
Yeah. So Derbyshire LGBT+, we were founded in 1983. So we've been around now 41 years, which is amazing. Initially set up to support gay men, particularly in Derby, with the HIV and AIDS crisis. And then we kind of morphed into Derbyshire Friend. And then in the last few years, with our new CEO, we've been Derbyshire LGBT+. So we're the only support organisation for lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans communities in the whole of the county.
That's mind-boggling, actually.
It really is. When you think about how huge Derbyshire is, and to get from one end to the other, you can be driving for 3 or 4 hours.
Easily, yeah.
You know, and you've got these amazing rural communities and towns and villages and Derby and Chesterfield. So we have two centres. We have Derby and Chesterfield, and we're the only LGBT organisation in the country to have two centres.
Is that true?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It kind of reflects the size of the county, but it also reflects the fact that in a lot of other surrounding counties, there aren't centres as such.
Mm.
So people will travel to us for support. So we run round about 32-ish support groups every month, a mixture of in-person and online. We cover the full spectrum of gender identities and sexual orientations, the full age range. So the youngest person we support, I think she's now 5, but she's been coming to our families group. since she was a baby in arms, and absolutely gorgeous.
Oh.
Family, just amazing. So the oldest person that we support is 94.
How fantastic is that? That there's a 94-year-old who's accessing these services. Yeah. I love that.
And the stories, because of course he grew up at a time when it was illegal to be gay, and you could be put in prison. Or, you know. So the stories that he can tell, and he's such a fascinating person. Just to sit and have a chat with him is amazing.
Wow.
Stories that make your toes curl, really.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Gosh. But so we run men's group, women's group, trans group, youth groups, which are really popular. So we have youth groups in Chesterfield, Long Eaton and Derby.
Mm.
We've got a wonderful youth worker. There's only four full-time members of staff. I know.
You see, this is the thing. I'm just thinking here because, like, this is making my eyes sort of open wide in astonishment. And I think that people think that, you know, being LGBT plus, it's you know, these days it's not a difficult thing to navigate. And there's four full-time members of staff. I mean, wow.
Yeah. Four full-time, three part-time, and we have a small group of really wonderful volunteers.
Yeah.
But, you know, without our volunteers, we couldn't do half the stuff that we do.
Mm.
We also have drop-ins. We do every week in Derby and every week in Chesterfield, where we don't know who's coming through the door for whatever reason.
Mm.
Sometimes people just come for a cup of tea and a biscuit and they'll go. Sometimes they'll be there for the full 4 hours that we're open and we're trying to push them out the door at the end.
Yes, I'm afraid we've got to close,
you know. And we support people seeking asylum, housing, hate crime. Because as you say, you know, there is this perception that things are a lot better. And yes, we have the Equality Act to support us and all that kind of stuff. But the daily experiences of many of us are still really horrendous.
I think, you know, there's a lot of attitudes that have been passed down in particular areas through particular viewpoints and families through the generations that are still very much rooted in the days of, as you say, somebody being LGBT plus being a figure of fun or dangerous or wrong in some way.
Mm.
And that's the real difficulty, isn't it? Trying to, you know, change those mindsets so that the daily experience is actually a much better one. And that is, I think, what's vital in the work that, you know, you do, especially.
Yeah.
Do you find then when people access your services that there's a proportion of people who can't come out to, you know, people in their lives that they deem important?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's still a thing.
Yeah, very much so. You know, when you think, you know, people are very careful how they present themselves to the world, how they dress, how they act in public.
Yeah.
You know, we have so many people who really, since I've been at D Plus since 2018, who have neighbour disputes. And you think, you know, your home is your safest place, or it should be.
It should.
And then, you know, you get people who are having their cars vandalised, their stuff posted through their letterbox, all these horrendous things going on. And you think, we are needed now more than ever before as an organisation. And yet we don't get any funding. We have to bid right for every penny that we have to keep us going.
Mm.
And we sell training packages, we sell our accreditation, we sell our manuals to schools to help us do the daily work that our communities need. And yeah, it's wonderful we've got the Equality Act, and yes, we can adopt and we can marry the person that we love and all that kind of stuff. But actually, when we still struggle to even walk down the street sometimes without being abused, and in the current political climate where trans people are being targeted,
vilified, and it's
vile.
Awful.
There's all this horrendous comments being made by politicians about trans people, and it's demonizing this group that doesn't have a voice, doesn't, you know, isn't able to fight back. And, you know, it puts me in mind of 1930s Europe.
Yeah.
Groups being targeted because they're different, and, oh, it's all right, they're not going to do anything about it, so we can, you know, we can say what we like, we can do what we like, because they're not going to fight back.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it's going to end. That's the horrendous thing. That's the really sad doesn't even cover it, does it? But that's the way we're going.
It's a tragedy. It really is. It's a tragedy.
We haven't learned from history.
And that's sort of leads me on to what I was going to ask you, actually, thinking about your years spent in education as a teacher. And coming forward to now, what is your take on the sort of the plight of LGBT plus youth, specifically for their representation, their visibility, and, you know, their support for authenticity to just be who they are? I mean, where has that come?
Well, I mean, the statistics that we have show that self-harm and suicide attempts amongst 12 to 18-year-olds are still high, higher than they should be, higher amongst trans young people. You know, and that was my story at secondary school, self-harm and suicide attempts, because of how I was treated. And I left school 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And that it's still happening now completely breaks my heart. It's unacceptable. And there's nobody doing anything about it, you know, who is in a position to say to teachers, use the right names, use the right pronouns.
Yeah.
And it very much, for a lot of our young people, it's a lottery about which school they go to. You get some amazing schools out there who will work with us readily, who just get it. And, you know, understand the impact on mental health for our young people. Those schools where they're really accepted, where they have a zero tolerance approach to homophobic, biphobic and transphobic bullying, are schools where our, strangely enough, where our young LGBT plus people are happiest.
Yeah, and do well in the things that they want to do, not the things that they have to do, because it's the only place they can find salvation.
And
I think, you know, I've worked a lot with coaching organisations, excuse me, around inclusion and belonging. I've consulted on policies. I've done public speaking on education, worked at Pride events. Little shout out to Pride in Belper there. And I know that there has been progress made. And I know that there are organisations, educational establishments that want to make that change. But as you say, we're a long way from that. And it's about the people who can make the differences at those societal levels, the policies and the politics involved. That's where there's still this chasm that is being used to polarise opinion.
Absolutely.
Does that feel like...
Completely, yeah.
A good description?
Yeah,
well, not
absolutely.
A good description, but a congruent description.
Yes, completely.
Yeah.
You know, as I say, there are some schools that really just get it. And that's, you know, that's great. There are other schools that don't have the first clue. And they're phoning us up, you know, and saying, oh, we've got a trans person who's just joined. What do we do? And as much as, you know, we'll work with absolutely everybody, the message for schools is write the policy before you get the young person along who needs it. Because when they've arrived, it's too late.
Yeah.
You need stuff in place. You need to be saying, particularly in schools, that everybody is valued, everybody is welcome, everybody is included, however they identify, whatever their background. You know, our young people need to know how loved and valued they are.
Yeah, they need that sense of belonging.
Yeah.
And I always think as well, when you said about having the policy in place before somebody arrives, because I think quite often what happens is people who identify as LGBT plus can be used to do the educating and the emotional labour to continuously be the person that, oh, that, right, we need to talk to that person about being trans.
Yeah.
They cannot speak on behalf of everybody, and they cannot continually show up every day for everybody else, because they themselves are actually in need of that, you know, safe space, that support, that kindness, that acceptance and understanding. I mean, we're not going to wave a magic wand and solve it, but what do you think needs to be the change then going forwards?
The change needs, it needs to be that our young people, our children and young people need that message that however they identify, however old they are, that they are loved. And I'm speaking about age because I think the younger our children get that message, the better, you know, and it's a responsibility of every member of the school community, every educator, whether they are a senior head teacher or senior leadership team, right down to your part-time teaching assistants. Everybody has that responsibility to educate and to show our young people and our children that it's okay. It's all right. I mean, yeah, this is how I have kind of felt and developed over the last, 20 or so years. You know, it shouldn't just be that gay member of staff who does the gay lesson on that one wet afternoon on a Wednesday, you know. It has much more impact if it's a straight cisgender member of staff doing that work. But quite often it's because as LGBT plus people, we've been through it. We can empathise with our students who are going through it.
Yeah.
We can understand where they're coming from. So in some ways it makes a lot of sense for the LGBT plus person to do that lesson. But as has happened to me, you get people then will say, well, you've got an agenda. You've got the gay agenda.
Oh, the gay agenda.
My only agenda is I want our young people to be able to get through school and be, you know, high levels of self-esteem and to be positive and confident and comfortable with who they are. That's my only agenda.
Oh, honestly, John, what a terrible agenda to have for somebody. Yeah. I mean, and that's it. Mm. We just want people to be able to show up as they are and be loved.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah?
And people always say to me, well, what if you've got somebody who's intent on being like a horrific person? I said, I don't really believe anybody is intent on that. I think people behave in those ways sometimes because they've been made to feel shame or that they're not good enough and that they don't belong. If we actually all treated each other with this kindness and this sense of belonging and that you're welcome as you are, I think we'd very quickly see that people just get on with life and love each other and care for each other. So here on The Way Forward, I'm all about empowerment. It's one of the founding values of the podcast. So I'm thinking about our lovely listeners. There's many of them, and maybe they identify as LGBT plus, or there's someone in their life that does. Maybe they support somebody who does, but they might be feeling alone, or they might not know what to do to support them. Have you got any sort of practical ideas or suggestions that you could just offer them today to give them that first step, which is a huge one, but something they can do to support their own emotional and mental wellness?
I think the first thing to say is you're not alone. There are others like you out there. And Derbyshire LGBT plus is there for everybody. You know, just pick up the phone. Pick up the phone or email us. There's always somebody that you can talk to about how you're feeling and what you're going through. And many of us have been in that position. You know, my driving force is to be the support that I needed growing up and as an adult. And I think, you know, we're here for you.
Yeah. I think that is a beautiful and very honest message, because I know that Derbyshire LGBT plus are there for the people that need them. And I'm going to put all the contact details in the show notes because I dearly want anybody listening to be able to get in touch so that they can start living life as they are, as an authentic version of themselves, and a joyful one, not having to fight and to battle. John, I can't thank you enough for your time and sharing your really difficult but completely inspiring lived experiences and all the empowering work you do for the LGBT plus community. It's been a really powerful conversation, and I just want to extend a final thank you for using your precious, amazing and finite energy to be here and, you know, talk with us today.
Thank you.
So that's it for today. And remember, if you are ready to prioritize you and work on anything related to your emotional well-being and empowerment in a fully supported way, just head over to my website. It's codesignwithfliss.com, and we can talk more about achieving the future that you hope for. Thank you so much for listening. Now we know more about LGBT plus experiences and the support out there. And now we know the way forward. I'm not the one who's always right.